There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast bringing together the best bits of today's show from Sunday, January the 19th.
We're talking about retirement and in particular how you save for your retirement. Well, our top story this morning is that radical new measures are being rolled out in Dubai's financial centre on the 1st of February. The old end-of-service gratuity system will be gone on the 31st of January, replaced with something a little bit more modern. The question is, though, what does it mean for the rest of us? Well, let's get the thoughts now of one of the lawyers who helped to write the legislation. Shiraz Setti is Middle East Managing Partner and Head of Employment at the law firm DWF Middle East. And we asked him, first of all, for the people down in the DIFC, the guinea pigs, if you like, for this. What does it mean for the system down there? And this is what he told us.
The end of service gratuity regime will be departed from on the 31st of January of this year. So we've got only a few more days left before end of service gratuity comes to an end in the DIFC. As of 1st of February, we will have what is called a qualifying scheme. So that is a retirement savings plan for every employee within the DIFC that will come into place. Employers will then have the opportunity to either pay out the end of service gratuity accrual up until the 31st of January or maintain it on their balance sheets and pay out as and when the employee leaves their employment. But there potentially may be a top-up that will need to be paid because end-of-service gratuity is paid on one's final salary.
So what do employers have to do now? And of course, it's not just the big investment banks. It's not just Goldman Sachs down in DIFC.
It's the sandwich people.
There's a bunch of stuff going on down there. This is what Shiraz told us.
First and foremost, employers need to notify the DIFC of who their authorised signatory is. And with that, they will then need to sign the deed of participation, which gets them into the actual scheme itself. That's number one. Number two, they need to register onto the platform and provide all employee data to Zurich, which are the scheme administrators. Thirdly, employers need to start having consultations with their employees and advising them of the changes and ensure that they've got buy-in from all of their staff. Fourthly, the employers need to put some time and effort into reviewing their existing contracts of employment, look at their policies and procedures, and implement a DIFC employee workplace savings scheme policy to have a look at how that will be dealt with internally. And lastly, they need to decide what they're going to do with their end of service gratuity liability.
I've got to say, some people, not everyone who works in DIFC is a banker with a huge salary. But quite a lot are. And if they're all getting their gratuities for the last 10, 15 years on the 31st of January, if you're selling sports cars or apartments or fancy dinners, you want to be doing a bit of marketing down there, I'd have thought.
Which actually brings up a really important point, which is there are some pros and cons to this, and there are some questions still to be answered. In that basket, I would put the fact that this is quite protective for employees, because as I understand it, even if you are fired for gross misconduct, you still end up with these benefits. It's not one of those things that, you know, you worry that it could all disappear if you do the wrong thing or you have the wrong falling out.
Because it's yours, isn't it?
Because it's yours. However, and there is also the question of what eventually is going to happen to this money. How is it going to be put to use? Because where we see pension schemes in other countries, we see them invested. They're making returns. I mean, pension funds in the US and in Europe are some of the biggest investors in a lot of spheres. But the third one is financial responsibility. Because one of the pros for the old gratuity scheme is that whilst a lot of people give up their pensions to live here, and I'm one of those, I wouldn't qualify for a New Zealand pension. You've got the money in the pot that you can't touch until you leave. If you are able to touch it, some people will do the right thing and invest it. Others will buy nice dinners and fancy cars.
So it's all well and good for the 20-odd thousand people who work down in DIFC. We're happy for you. Big changes there. What about the other 9.8 million people who live here in the UAE and don't work in a financial centre? Well, listen up, because according to Shiraz Setti of the law firm DWF, it could be rolled out across the country sooner than we think.
There has definitely been a discussion around bringing this into the wider UAE. The DIFC have been used as a pilot to see how successful this plan will become. It is definitely something that the DIFC are pioneering because they want to be one of the best international financial hubs in the world. They are looking at other key jurisdictions that have this in place. The UAE as a whole, the Ministry of Human Resources and Amortization, have also have been discussing this. And in my view, going forward, there will definitely be a plan to bring this out and roll this out into the wider UAE.
Which will have implications for all of us. If you want to hear the full interview with Shiraz, it will be available as a podcast on our website.
If I ever get out of here, thought of giving it all away to a registered charity.
We are talking extradition treaties this morning because the word extradition is one that I feel like we've used on the Business Breakfast more than we have in the last week, than we have in substantial time. Carlos Ghosn, of course, is the big one. A lot has been made of the fact that there is no extradition treaty between Japan and Lebanon after he fled Japan, maybe, maybe not, in a box designed for musical instruments. But it got us thinking about how extradition treaties actually work. We throw the word around, but do people actively go looking for you? Who pays the bill if you are extradited? And who does the UAE actually have extradition treaties with? Not suggesting that we're giving you a one-on-one on how to do a runner at all, but we're interested in what the UAE's position is on this.
We are indeed. We've also been hearing from people who've had experience of quote-unquote doing a runner, not necessarily themselves, but people who have been affected by it. This caller, who understandably did not want to be named, says that he became someone else's scapegoat.
This was back in 2003, which I just came over to Dubai. We've been recruited by someone. And 3 months later, he basically packed up and made a runner. And I was basically implicated in a case which wasn't really related to me. But he made a runner, and then took me about a year to clear myself in the local court and get my passport back in the end. Yeah, it was quite a challenge to not be convicted for something that you didn't do. I mean, there was a lot of money involved, but finally, I guess the evidence showed that I wasn't guilty.
We've had another caller who said he loaned some money to a friend and he never got it back.
I met him in 2005 when I moved to Dubai. He was very friendly. He was my neighbor in Dubai. And later on, I realized he might have some trouble with banks. He took some loans and credit cards and so on. And I helped him once. He needed money urgently to pay out some of the installments. So I gave him 10,000 dirhams once. And then a few months later, I was asking him when is he going to return back the money. And then suddenly he just disappeared. And I came to know that he left the country. He went to the UK and I never heard back from him.
There you go. We've also had another caller saying that he had a friend in trouble. This is the story.
I have a friend who moved to Dubai years and years ago. And when he moved here, his employer basically did a bit of a trick on him and said that he either needs to hand in his passport or give him a blank check as, I don't know, security or what have you, that he wouldn't, I don't know, you know how it was a few years ago here. So of the two bad options, he chose to give a blank check. When he left the company, he left, there was a bit of an acrimonious departure, and they ended up owing him some salaries. So he raised the case in the Dubai courts, got a phone call from the police thinking that it was them calling him about the case that he'd raised, telling him to come in the next day. Came in the next day and they told him that this former employer of his took that blank check, put a sum of 500,000 dirhams on it and tried to cash it. And they gave him 24 hours to come up with the money or basically come to the police station. He doesn't really have much of an option, and he ran off. Well, he left because he had the option was either, you know, get arrested or leave with his family and never come back.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We are talking extradition, much analysis and speculation about the lack of an extradition treaty between Japan and Lebanon in the wake of Carlos Ghosn fleeing Japan. Meanwhile, in London, Arif Naqvi fighting an extradition request to the US. He's got a hearing coming up about that. It's got us thinking on the Business Breakfast about how extradition actually works. We are joined now in the studio by Raza Mithani, who is a partner at the law firm Brian Cave Leighton Paisner. It's very nice to see you, Raza. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Brandy.
And obviously you can't comment directly on any of the cases playing out in the press at the moment, but you can talk to us about extradition in general. What is the legal case around extradition? How, in kind of layman's terms, does it work?
So there are a couple of elements to it. The first is that one has to have a requesting state. So a state which is making a request of another state for an individual to be returned in order to either stand trial for a particular crime or alternatively in order to be sentenced or punished for a crime. So that's the basic framework.
Who does the UAE have extradition agreements with?
Well, the UAE actually has quite a number of extradition agreements. So as you'd expect, it has extradition agreements with other GCC countries. There's the Arab Riyadh Convention, which includes not only the other GCC countries, but a number of other Arab countries. And really, if you look at the scheme of the various treaties that the UAE has entered into, they reflect the makeup of the expat population within the UAE itself. So there's a treaty with the United Kingdom, there's a treaty with Australia, there's one with India, one with the Philippines, there's even a treaty with the Republic of Kazakhstan.
How proactive are the countries that receive the extradition notices? I mean, how does it work in practice? Will they hunt out someone who has gone to ground, or is it more passive? I mean, we hear about people being found walking on the streets of London.
Well, it really depends upon what you mean by hunt out or being proactive. So the basis for an extradition is a request. In the absence of a request, a state will not go looking generally for individuals whom they think may have committed crimes in other countries or jurisdictions. The slight exception to that is something called an Interpol red notice. Where there's an Interpol red notice, then a state will effectively arrest somebody at a border in order to stop that person from escaping. But again, that's partly based upon a request to Interpol from the requesting country.
And who pays? I mean, do the requesting countries end up with an extradition bill? One economy class seat, two policemen's time, Coke and a packet of crisps?
Well, I suspect that that's something that probably depends upon the terms of the treaties, but generally one would expect that the countries themselves would bear the cost, because the nature of these treaties is that they are reciprocal. So both countries have very similar rights and obligations under the treaties.
How often are they actually used? It feels at the moment like we are seeing the word extradition in headlines more and more. Is it something that is on the rise for executives, for financial misnomers? I mean, Carlos Ghosn obviously is the big one making headlines at the moment. Or is it just that our reporting of them is increasing?
Well, as you rightly say, there's certainly a number of very high-profile examples that have taken place recently. It's probably fair to say that the degree of cooperation between states, so far as extradition is concerned, is increasing over time. And if one just takes an example, a practical example, the treaty between the United Kingdom and the UAE, the number of extraditions that have taken place under that treaty over the last 10 years has been much greater than those that took place previously. And I think partly that's a reflection of the fact that states recognise the importance of cooperation in order to catch criminals, because we live in a world that's global. And not only is trade global, but criminality is too.
What level of criminality, though, leads to an extradition? I mean, if I was to leave the UAE without paying my Etisalat bill, I'm assuming that there wouldn't be an Interpol red notice out for me.
It depends on the amount of your Etisalat bill, Brandy. No, but jokes aside, it depends upon the terms of the treaty itself. And it really depends upon which states we are talking about. If one is talking about the UAE, there is a requirement under the local UAE legislation that the crime in question is punishable in the state making the request by at least imprisonment of 1 year or a more severe punishment. And there's also a further requirement that if that crime had been committed in the UAE, that crime would be punishable in the UAE by imprisonment of at least 1 year. So really, we're talking about very serious offences. We're not talking about somebody who's failed to pay a parking ticket and has forgotten about it and gone back to Australia or New Zealand or the UK.
Why doesn't everyone just flee to places where there are no extradition agreements? Why doesn't everyone end up in tiny little countries in South America?
Well, that's a good question. I suspect partly that's because not everybody wants to go and live in a tiny country in South America. So that may well be one consideration.
Reza Mithani, partner at the law firm Brian Cave Leighton Pesner, thank you very much for joining us on the Business Breakfast this morning.
Thank you.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. Newsmakers.
The movers and shakers shaping your world.
And this morning we're talking about people who are quitting their jobs, taking early retirement. Three of them we have to go through this morning.
The first one is the man who wrote these books.
You think you're above the law, but I'm not the law. So you should start running because I'm going to start hunting.
That's Tom Cruise in the movie Jack Reacher, written by
Lee Child, who pretty much shocked the literary world over the weekend and made the front page of the Times with a photograph that went all the way to the fold. You would think someone had died. Literally, the tributes pouring in on Twitter make it sound like something far more serious has happened than Lee Child just quitting Jack Reacher. But that is what he has done. Jack Reacher, more than 100 million books sold by Lee Child since he started the series, which he did relatively late, by the way. He started at 40, not you, Siri. He started at 40.
You weren't supposed to catch it, Siri. It wasn't directed at you. Get back in your box.
He started at 40 and has become, I mean, a megastar. People who love Lee Child and his creation, Jack Reacher, feel very, very, very passionately about it. But he's retiring. He's announced that he is going to not kill off Jack Reacher, which he had thought about doing. He thought about, how do I kill off this character? And then I think realised that A, it would take an army to bring down Jack Reacher because he survived pretty much everything that Lee Child has thrown at him so far. And then also said, no, he needs to keep going. So he's giving him to his brother.
This is fascinating.
Who is a writer himself called Andrew Grant. And he's saying, look, you know, I didn't have to twist his arm into doing it. It became along naturally. People don't care who writes the books. They only care about Reacher. So he's giving it to his brother, but only if he changes his surname to Child, becoming Andrew Child, prompting a lot of wit on Twitter this weekend about how any child could write these books.
Oh, boom, boom.
But it does seem that the publisher doesn't necessarily agree with Lee Child that no one will care who writes them, because the next Reacher novel, apparently, Random Penguin House, the publishing house, is going to write Lee Child with Andrew Child on the front of it. So sort of a bit of a segue, at least to start.
And we've had this from before, haven't we? From people like John Grisham. And we've had it from James Patterson as well, haven't we?
Who has a stable of writers. And, I mean, there's all sorts of rumours about how that stable actually works. But he's certainly not the only one in those books. And people don't mind. James Patterson, still a humongous bestseller. And also someone, by the way, who does a huge amount of good, giving a lot of the money that he makes from his books to independent bookstores. But when you have something that people feel as emotionally about as the Jack Reacher books, will Lee Child get away with this?
I think he will. And we've seen it also with the James Bond novels as well, that Ian Fleming died decades ago, and yet now every year you get a new James Bond novel by a different guest writer who is always an author of note. One of them was set in the flipping Intercontinental Hotel in Dubai Festival City, where the Literature Festival is held.
Well, and we've had Agatha Christie novels now being written by Sophie Hannah, but I've heard Sophie Hannah speak about the, you know, what you kind of come up against doing this, because you have rabid superfans who are watching your every single move, and you can't do anything that, you know, Agatha Christie herself would not have done, or whoever it is. Was it Jeffrey Deaver who, with one of the Bond novels, I think, came under a lot of criticism? Not entirely sure.
It was his that was set in the Intercon Festival City, because he wrote it when he was here for the Lit Fest, didn't he?
But it's tricky, because the fans are very, very wedded to things being true to life. So there's one of my retirees this morning, an early retirement for Lee Child.
Someone else who's retiring is this guy.
Salut, c'est Jean-Paul Gaultier. Je t'invite pour mes 50 ans de carrière au Théâtre du Châtelet le 22 janvier. Tu viens? Ça sera une grande fête avec beaucoup de mes amis. On va beaucoup s'amuser. Hein. Ça va se terminer très tard, je crois.
That is Jean-Paul Gaultier. Allow me to translate, because my French is excellent. That's a video that Jean-Paul Gaultier put out on his social media saying, I'm going to give you a scoop. This will be my last haute couture show. He's got one on Wednesday. My last Gaultier Paris show. You have to come. You can't miss it. Because he has said that he is stepping back from making the clothes. He's 67 years old. He's, since he was a teenager, he's had a 50-year career. He is turning his back on the fashion and the perfume side of his business. Himself, he now only does the haute couture. He stopped making the ready-to-wear clothes, the on-the-rails-at-the-shop clothes, if you like, a couple of years ago. But he says that Gaultier Paris will continue, but he will not be making the clothes. He's going to be getting involved in another creative project. We don't know what it is yet. He says he's going to tell us later. So he's going to continue doing something else. The clothing will continue with someone else, but it will not be him.
And he is pretty much bang on the same age as Lee Child, the author we just mentioned. Not an old person. These are not people in their 80s who are thinking, okay, I haven't got the mental or manual dexterity anymore. They're still, they've looked after themselves, they're fit, they're you would argue, in the prime of their lives and their careers.
And obviously are looking to do other things. You don't need to be doing one thing for the whole of your life, even if you are still arguably at the top of your game.
So those are two of our quitters this weekend. Lee Child, the author, Jean-Paul Gaultier, the designer, and also quitting this weekend, this actress.
Hi, can I help you?
I'm good. He's just signing for these packages. Thank you.
So what's going on here?
Sorry?
Is this one of those hidden camera shows?
What do you mean?
What I mean is, like, you're way too cute to be just a FedEx girl. I mean, you got to be like a model or actress or something, right? Like, what happens when I open up one of these boxes? Something's going to jump out?
No, nothing's going to jump out. I'm just a FedEx girl.
Who is just a FedEx girl, Brandy Scott?
Oh, she's not just a FedEx girl anymore. That is Meghan Markle.
It is Meghan Markle, or the Duchess of Sussex, as she's now styled. Look, the new development over the weekend is this. Overnight, the British royal family has issued details of how the aforementioned Duchess of Sussex and her husband, Prince Harry, the Duke of Sussex, are going to split from the royal family. And they're going to split quite decisively. The question that everyone's asking, including the BBC, is this. How will Harry and Meghan make money? Because they're not going to get money from the British government anymore. Their royal residence in the UK, which they had as a kind of grace and favour apartment or cottage, they're going to have to pay rent on. It was recently refurbished for £2.5 million, about, 10 million dirhams. They're going to have to pay that back. So how are they going to make ends meet, flying around the world between Canada, the United States, the UK, and goodness knows where else? Well, it seems, with comparative ease, I've been crunching the numbers on this, and even though they've given up their royal salary,
and their HRHs,
and that they are no longer his and her Royal Highness, they are still going to receive a bunch of money. For example, only 5% of Prince Harry's money comes from the government. 95% comes from his dad through a complex network of companies that he owns called the Duchy of Cornwall. But he gets about 3 million quid a year for that. I've crunched the numbers. It's about 15 million dirhams a year. It's about 1.5 million dirhams a month. You could get by on that. His net worth is estimated as an individual, money inherited from his mum, Princess Diana, and various others, about 40 million quid, which is going to give you another, if you've invested it properly, million dirhams a month. Meghan had a successful career as an actress. That was her in the movie Horrible Bosses. She made most of her money from the TV series Suits. She's worth several million dollars. So even before they get up in the morning, they've got 2.5 million dirhams a month to live on that just arrives without them doing anything. The question is, though, how are they going to earn a living? She could go back to acting. People have suggested perhaps influencers. And Sussex Royal has 11 million followers.
And this is it, isn't it? Because there's speculation that a lot of the discussions that have been held over the last couple of days have been around exactly how that bit of it's going to work. To quote, I think, one unnamed source in the Daily Mail, no one wants to see the Sussex name on a carton of margarine.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
We are talking the business of fast cars because the UAE is set to get its first supercar factory. W Motors is moving production of its sports cars from Italy to Dubai Silicon Oasis. Ralph DeBess, the founder and CEO of W Motors, is in the studio with us now. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Talk us through this decision. Why are you moving your production facilities from Italy to Dubai?
Well, we've been based here in Dubai since 2012. So we started expanding the company here, investing a lot into growing the operations of W Motors in Dubai. And it made sense for us to start moving the production as well eventually since we started the operations in Dubai. So today we're proud to announce that we have broken ground on our production facility and gathering all the expertise that we have between Europe here and all around the world, putting it all under one roof, made perfect sense for us.
But it is a big leap. I mean, a lot of companies will have headquarters or regional headquarters here, will have started here, moved here, but the production seems to be the last thing that ever, if ever, gets brought into the UAE. What are the challenges in even just making this decision?
Yeah, well, from the beginning, W Motors was not about building a car. It was building an industry, the automotive industry, bringing it to the Middle East, starting it somewhere from an Arab country. So putting the production side here, we knew we had challenges. We knew that it's not easy to do that, but it had to happen eventually. Now, the challenges that we have is a supply chain that we need to build from zero, is getting the expertise and the people to work and the labor that has to work in the highest level possible, which we're willing to train on the next 2-3 years, and then building high quality vehicles. Now, this is something we've known how to do for the past 10 years. It's something that we're ready to take the challenge, and I believe we're quite excited because economically as well, it makes sense to add something new to the industry, to bring 500 new jobs in the next few years in a completely new sector that people initially are excited about. So it is quite a good challenge that we are looking to face.
What's the cost of doing it though?
Doing what? Do you mean the manufacturing side?
Bringing the manufacturing here. How much is it costing you, A, in setting up your factory here, but then also, B, in moving away from what you're doing in Italy?
It's actually, it's a question of, it's mathematics. It's going to cost us less, let's say, to produce locally here, and yet the investment, of course, initially is quite high. So we're looking to invest over $100 million in the UAE in the next few years between phase one, phase two of the manufacturing facility, between building, between labor, between R&D, technology, and products that are coming out. And it's different phases. So now we're starting now with phase one, which is going to be ready by end of this year.
And in terms of what you were doing in Italy, will you be shutting that down completely, still keeping it to do some manufacturing?
We're still going to keep Italy as a back office. We work with multinationals as well in Europe, so it's always good to have a base in Europe to support the developments and the R&D. However, the main bulk of the manufacturing will be in Dubai.
Can you find the talent you need here?
We can. You'll be surprised. There are many, many talents that we're actually training today as internships in our offices and our design centers. And the talent is growing. The demand on this sector is actually growing. But definitely, you know, we still have to rely on international expertise to come in bit by bit to switch it 100% to be local expertise.
Messages coming in. Green in Dubai writes, how many supercars do we really need here in the UAE? What we need is affordable electric cars.
Absolutely. I agree to that. I mean, the supercars is definitely a niche market that we tap into by creating the brand, creating W Motors, which is an international, globally renowned brand. However, here in Dubai, the factory is going to be focused mainly on green technology, advanced technologies, autonomous driving vehicles, police vehicles, which we're doing now for Dubai police, as well as electric supercars, and later on, maybe more affordable cars.
Because you have a joint venture in China, don't you, called Iconiq,
yeah,
which is making relatively affordable electric cars. Tell us about that business and tell us why you're not building a factory to make those cars in Dubai Silicon Oasis.
In China, indeed. In China, is a completely different venture that we have there, which is creating mass production affordable vans, full electric as well. But we built this company initially for the Chinese market to import some vehicles here later on in the next few years. However, it's a completely different business case. To do such an investment and such a mass production project, it needs huge support from the government, high risks, and it's not necessarily very profitable in the next few years. So for Dubai, to create something new, we wanted to create something more glamorous, internationally renowned, and to go into the technology side more than just the automotive side.
You mentioned earlier that you're looking to build an industry, and one of the things that you'll be setting up isn't just a factory, it's also an automotive academy. How much of a player in the car sector could the UAE actually become, realistically?
Realistically, the UAE has a very, very big potential to become one of the leaders, not only in the region, but also to export the technology, export the talent overseas. So building an academy made also sense for us by creating also the complete ecosystem from industry, manufacturing, and education combined all together. And hopefully in the next few years, you'll start seeing talent being exported from the UAE in a new sector that nobody's ever seen.
Because we have seen some disruption, haven't we? I mean, we've seen Elon Musk come in, the valuations of his company at the moment, incredible at a time when the American and the European giants are struggling. What aspect of that disruption are you looking to tap to benefit from?
Well, basically, we're not looking to tap into to compete with anybody else, but we're looking to set up a base, set up something that's completely new. So by creating a new industry, that's what we said, we're looking to tap into new sectors that other industries, other OEMs might rely on, like technology, software, battery developments, motor developments. And these are things that the future is happening, that the future needs in the automotive revolution that is happening today. So basically, I do believe the UAE is quite well positioned today with its talent, with its companies and its exposure on a global level, especially on the marketing side, to have Dubai and the UAE to be positioned everywhere in the world to be the leader in wherever you go. So it does make sense for us to grow this industry even further and hopefully attract even more talent, more companies to come set up base here.
So when will the first car roll off your production line here? Have you got a month?
Of course. I think we're talking by end of this year. If I say October, November, which is the target that we have, I think our PR is going to shoot me. But this is the target that we have now by end of this year to have the first car rolling out and hopefully the first full electric car rolling out by beginning of 21 from the UAE, from the Dubai Silicon Oasis.
Does the first car already have an owner? Has it already been sold? Marked?
Of course. The first cars are already being produced now in Italy, and the owner is already accounted for.
But the first UAE car?
First UAE car is also, so we're switching the production from there to here. So all these production cars that we're producing are already sold and are going to be delivered to their clients. And it will be quite nice to see the clients coming to the factory in Dubai for the first time and taking delivery of their cars, which has never been done before.
Ralf de Beers, founder and CEO of W Motors, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. Rich and I will be back in the studio tomorrow morning, 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcast at DubaiEye1038.com.